This Fred and Jeff Show podcast is brought to you by Five Star Pest Control, Anthony's Cigar Emporium, and Arizona Party Rental.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, for your further listening pleasure...
Direct from the golf course and onto your radio, this is...
Hello, everybody.
The Fred and Jeff Show.
Good morning, Tucson. This is Jeff Ronstadt, and you are on 104.1 and the Fred and Jeff Show. Fred is gone today. He's out screwing around doing something that he wouldn't share with me. But that's okay, because as his little brother, I'm here to carry the water for him. Whatever you're doing out there, Fred, I hope you're having fun. Because I'm going to have fun in the studio today with a lot of Tucsonans that are doing great things in Southern Arizona. So this is the Fred and Jeff Show, and we talk about the people, the events, the places, the culture, the history that make Tucson and Southern Arizona such a wonderful place to live. And you can check us out at fredandjeff.com, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter. And Lauren, our little intern, has got all kinds of cool things that she's been posting on Facebook. So there's stuff that's going on at the Loft Theater, Happy Tuesdays, things going on at the Children's Museum of Tucson. Science Sundays, I think, is ending at the end of this month, so get your kids down there on Sunday to have fun at Science Sundays. The new lemurs are at the zoo. The weather is a little warm, but it's starting to cool down. And we have lots and lots and lots of fun things going on here in Southern Arizona. And the first fun thing that we have going on here in Southern Arizona is a great group of people. The Boy Scouts of America. My little guy Larry is a wee below. So we love the Boy Scouts. And in the studio with us this morning are three of our favorite people. Ken Tucker from the Boy Scouts. You're the ED, right, Ken?
That's right, yep.
So Executive Director of the Boy Scouts. We have Amber Mazzi, the Development Director. Hi, Amber.
Hi.
And we've got Brent Rustan, who is a board member and the chairman of this year's One Day 100 Holes of Golf. Who will take the challenge for the Boy Scouts of America Golf Marathon? How you doing, buddy?
Great. How you doing, Jeff?
Good, good, good. Thanks for coming in, guys. So, 100 holes of golf. Have you guys ever seen that routine that Robin Williams did about golf and how the Scottish are tricksters?
I've never seen that.
We'll post it on the Fred and Jeff Show website.
Yeah.
Because Robin Williams talks about how 18 holes of golf is torture enough. But you want to do 100 holes of golf? What's going on here?
100 holes of golf in one day to raise some money for the Boy Scouts.
All right, Amber, tell us how that works.
Simple enough. We are asking golfers to come out and take the challenge, golf 100 holes on October 25th, and we ask them to get pledges. So like a pledge-a-thon, they're going to go out and ask friends and family and corporate sponsors to pledge their golf game,
right,
for 100 holes.
So like bowl-a-thons, you know, like Big Brothers Big Sisters, they do that bowl-a-thon every year.
Yep.
You give someone a nickel for every pin they knock over.
Yep.
Is this per stroke?
Per hole.
Oh, because if folks gave me like a nickel per stroke, you guys would you wouldn't have to fundraise anymore.
Be our last fundraiser.
Yeah. Maybe that'll be next year's fundraiser.
Right? Well, you just have to chase them around to collect.
Yeah.
That's very cool. This is a great idea. How long have you guys been doing this?
This is our first year. They're kicking it off this year, and so we're excited to give it a try. You know, it's kind of a new, unique thing, and not very many folks are doing this in Tucson, so we're excited to go for it.
I would say that nobody is doing this in Tucson.
I think there's one other organization that I've heard of, but surprisingly, with as much golf as is played here,
tons.
Yeah, this is it's a pretty new and unique idea.
And so how do people get involved in this? Clearly, you're out there recruiting folks to golf, right, Brent?
Absolutely. Yeah, we're working on people to golf. We have a website set up. They can go on there. They can go on there. They can pledge. They can do to golfers that are already signed up, or they can sign up themselves to be a golfer and go out and gather pledges.
Is there a minimum?
There is.
Yeah, the goal is to for each golfer to raise $10 per hole.
Okay,
so that translates to $1,000. But it, you know, it's pretty easy to talk about with folks, you know, and to ask if they would give like a buck per hole to sponsor. I mean, you know, I'm playing, so you would probably give me a buck per hole.
I would give you a buck per hole. I wouldn't give you a buck a swing though.
Yeah, no. Yeah, you wouldn't want to do
because
that.
Because then my children wouldn't be able to go to college. And I'm talking any college. You know?
That's right. <yeah. laughs>
That's cool. So this is going to be at Torres Blancas Golf Club.
Right.
Yeah. All right. And that's
down in Green Valley.
In Green Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And if people want more information about how to get involved, Amber, where should they go?
They should go to bsagolf.com to learn more about the event.
All right. What are we missing? Sounds like a great, it sounds like it's a real easy event. You know, you get out there, you're going to give guys as much, I don't know, adult libations as possible to make it through the 100 holes.
That's right, yes.
Or you'll have caddies falling around, mules with water.
Oh, there'll be plenty of food and drinks, and we'll have a great time. We're just combining golf, great thing, with an endurance sport, like a Spartan race or something. So,
Wait a minute. You are making a comparison between golf and an endurance sport?
Well, not a comparison. We are combining the two.
Combining the two, golf.
The greatest event, yes.
I love. So do you have to, is it like a marathon? You got to run from hole to hole to hole to hole?
We actually give you carts on this one. We can't take the golfers that far.
Yeah, because that's, a, I can imagine, I wonder what the over and under are going to be on blisters for this event.
It's going to be pretty high.
It's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
So, all right, folks, so if you want to get involved in this awesome event, and Ken, tell our listeners, the maybe one or two out there that don't know who the Boy Scouts are, what do you guys, what's the thing that you try to instill in the young men in our community?
Well, and not only young men, we work with young women as well, teenage women in our venturing and exploring programs. But we're about instilling values in young people to help them make ethical decisions over their lifetime. Most of what we do is in the outdoors, but we have career-based programs as well, and so leadership and ethical-based programming.
And isn't there, there was a study done that the kids in your program that make it all the way to Eagle Scout go on to do amazing things?
Yeah, Baylor University just came out with a study about Eagle Scouts, and it's phenomenal the impact the program has on young men that achieve that rank, which is really only 4% of Boy Scouts that join the program actually make it to Eagle Scout.
Yeah, from the son of an Eagle Scout.
Yeah.
And Fred and I are, and our grandfather was an Eagle Scout too.
That's right.
And for some reason, you guys just wouldn't take Fred and I.
Well.
And I don't know what that's all about, but, you know.
We probably don't want to go back and revisit that.
You know, I spent years in therapy to get over that one, so we're not going to go through there again. Well, guys, good luck.
Thank you.
Your event sounds fantastic. Folks, if you want to get involved, they should go to, what's the website again?
BSAGolf.com.
Boy Scouts of America, BSAGolf.com. Find someone to golf. You guys can golf. Find someone to pledge. All the money stays here locally.
Absolutely.
Helps the kids in our community. You guys, thanks for what you do. Brett, Amber, Ken, thank you guys for what you do.
Thank you, Jeff.
Appreciate it.
Folks like you make Tucson a great place to live because you care. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Take a day off work and come have fun with us.
Absolutely, absolutely. All right, folks, we're going to take our first break. When we're done, Fred may magically appear. I'm not going to count on it. But if he does, we'll be back with more here on Fred and Jeff Show.
This portion of the Fred and Jeff Show is brought to you by Barker Morrissey Contractors, Casa de la Luz Hospice, and the Downtown Tucson Partnership.
Now, time for more of the Fred and Jeff Show on 104.1 The Truth.
And welcome back here on the Fred and Jeff Show. This is Jeff Ronstadt without my big brother Fred, who gosh knows where Fred is today. He's out there probably sleeping off a tequila. That's not true. Just kidding, Fred. Fred has business elsewhere that he's been called away to. So I'm manning the boat for the both of us today. And this is the Fred and Jeff Show, where we talk about the people, the places, the events, history, and culture of Tucson and Southern Arizona. And you can go to fredandjeff.com to listen to past shows, check out our sponsors, support our sponsors. And you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, because Fred tweets, you know, once every couple of weeks, probably about some meal that he's just had that he thought was really good. So today on the show, we just had the fabulous folks from the Boy Scouts, their golf marathon folks. So if you were listening earlier, we were talking about the one day, 100 holes of golf. take the challenge at the Torres Blancas Golf Club on in Green Valley. The event is October 25th, so you've got plenty of time to sign up or support somebody to support the Boy Scouts of America, a fabulous organization. And in the studio with us now are some more guests, and we've got two folks from the U of A. We've got Greg Leonard, and we've got Janet Hawley. And how are you guys doing today?
Doing good.
Great.
I'm delighted to be here.
We're delighted to have you. So, Janet, you are, if I can read your handwriting, you're a clinical professor and speech-language pathologist. Tell us what a clinical professor and speech-language pathologist does.
Well, I work at the University of Arizona with some of the best graduate clinicians in the country, training them to become professional speech pathologists. We work with clients. I work predominantly with adults with communication disorders, usually due to neurogenic problems.
Neurogenic problems?
Meaning that they've had injury to their brain from a stroke or a traumatic brain injury, maybe a tumor removal. So.
And what are the ages of the folks you work with?
Predominantly adults, maybe even adolescents, 16 to my oldest patient's 93.
Wow, 93 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And how long have you been doing this?
Oh, you're trying to date me here.
No, dating. I just want everybody that's listening to know that you are.
I've been doing this more than 30 years, I think.
Okay, great. So you really know what you're doing.
I like to think so. I'm training students, so I hope I do. They keep me on my toes.
All right, that's awesome. How long have you been a professor?
About 12 years, been at the university.
And where are you from?
I'm from California, but I came out here for graduate school at the university. And then I worked at some local hospitals, treating patients very similar to the ones I treat now at the university.
And speech pathology is not a very common job. How did you fall in love with speech pathology?
Well, it's interesting. I've been asked that question before. I was going to college, and at that time, during college, my grandmother had a stroke, and there were no speech pathologists out in rural Kansas. So I started thinking about the profession and was taking a fabulous course at the time in that department, speech pathology.
By way of coincidence?
Yes. So I made a decision. It requires an advanced degree. So it was a decision, did I want to go on in school? And I did. So I've never looked back. I love it. It's a fabulous profession if you like to help people.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And so where do you find most of your patients? Are they referred to you through University of Arizona Medical Center, or how do you find the folks that you work with?
We have a lot of self-referrals, actually. We're very well known for our aphasia program, so a lot of people hear about us or find out about us online. Physicians refer to us. Community agencies know of us. So some of it's word of mouth, though. And then, yes, from University of Arizona Medical Center as well.
Now, a minute ago, you said aphasia. What's aphasia?
Aphasia is an acquired language disorder, usually affecting adults, meaning that they have had some kind of injury to their brain, usually due to a stroke or a traumatic brain injury, sometimes a tumor, affecting the language centers of the brain. Most people, about 90% of people, that's in the left hemisphere of their brain. Because it's sudden, this is very different than, say, a developmental disability where you're born with difficulties, but these are people who've led normal lives and suddenly find it extremely difficult to communicate. So they may not be able to name very simple things that they know what it is, but they can't think of the word. It ranges quite a bit. Some people have very mild difficulties and just can't think of an occasional word, and other people are simply unable to put words together at all.
But the folks that you work with specifically are folks that have had a traumatic brain injury?
Or a stroke.
Or stroke.
Yeah, traumatic brain injury is usually someone who's been in a car accident or something like that.
So. Right. And now, what about folks that over time lose capacity to speak?
Well, there is something called primary progressive aphasia, which is exactly what you're describing. And that's another type of aphasia that we see, people who have a slow onset of difficulty communicating. And unlike dementia, where you also lose your memory and your personality, these folks retain their thinking skills but just have this difficulty communicating. And that's what aphasia is. Usually we talk about it like loss of language, not intellect.
So it's more than just a senior moment, like I have all the time, even though I'm not quite a senior yet.
Right. We all start to have trouble thinking of words occasionally as we age, but it's more, you know, predominant than that. It's more.
And how do you help these people? Can you give us an example of someone that comes into you that's had a stroke? What's the course of treatment for someone to try to get back to as close as normal as possible?
Well, we offer both individual therapy services as well as groups. And a big part of what we do is these aphasia groups. So we group people together based on their level of communication. So someone who has very severe communication problems would probably be grouped with other people who have similar issues, and mild with mild. And then in those groups, we work on both helping them to recover their skills as well as to compensate.
Now,
so they learn strategies.
Okay.
Some folks can learn to, if they can write the first letter, then sometimes they can cue themselves to think of the word. Other people sometimes will gesture, and in the process of gesturing, like showing themselves cutting with their fingers, like they're cutting with scissors, the word scissors may pop out. Our brains are organized in very interesting ways, so sometimes you can kind of trick your brain into helping those words, you know, come back. So,
well, you bring up a great point. Our brains are very, very, very interesting organs in our body. And there's a lot of research being done every day about how they work.
Well, my famous line is that the brain is the final frontier, not space, not the bottom of the ocean, but the brain. We're learning new things every day. The University of Arizona has an aphasia research project, and we do a lot of very interesting research with primary progressive aphasia, a lot with reading and writing. If I didn't mention that, aphasia can affect speaking, comprehending, reading, and writing, and in some cases even gestural language, because that's also a symbolic type of language.
So these folks that come in and work with you, they cannot speak, they can't write oftentimes, they can't gesture, they're kind of trapped inside themselves, and you're the ones that are helping them to be able to communicate again.
Exactly. And for some people, we use devices. There are augmentative alternative communication devices, some that can speak for them.
How do
sometimes
they do that?
Is there
like a keyboard or something?
Yeah, there's some devices that they can look at some pictures and sequence the picture. So maybe it's a picture of go and then a picture of a dog, and then they could put in go dog, and then the device could say that, and someone would say, oh, you want to go see your dog at the pound or something like that, you know, so they can put together communication through a device. Other people, we have picture books that they use. We personalize those with family members. A lot of folks today use iPads. There's a lot of apps with iPads that help people communicate. So we're very creative. I'm very fortunate to work with graduate students who are incredibly young and creative, and they come up with a lot of really good ideas.
Well, that's fantastic.
And we get together in these groups, and the patients practice these strategies. And we have a lot of fun. You know, it's a very devastating kind of thing, but when we get together, we laugh and enjoy each other's company and can communicate about adult topics despite their level of communication difficulty.
Do you find that humor really helps?
I really do. I think that's one of the biggest reasons patients come to the groups, is that they have other people that they're with who can understand what they're dealing with, who don't judge them, who communicate at their pace, and who can laugh, you know, with them, along with them.
And it is very healing. Good for you guys. Yeah. That's awesome. That's a lot of hard work. How long is the progression? If you have someone that comes in from the beginning after they've had that traumatic brain injury or stroke to when they're actually able to communicate, how long, what's your average time typically with folks?
I knew you'd ask that, Jeff, and that's always a tough question. It really depends on how severe the original injury was. So if you had a very mild stroke, very small amount of brain injury, those people can recover pretty quickly and over several months. But for many people, it may be years and years. And some may hit a point where they're pretty functional at communicating, but they may know they're not quite the same as they were. So they may want to, like I have patients who come for 8 years to groups, you know,
wow,
for many, many years. And they continue to find that they gain from that process.
Oh, that's fabulous. Good for you. Yeah. You must be a very, very patient person.
Well, I think I've learned it through this process. I've really gained more patience as I've gone along because, yes, it requires a lot of patience.
Yeah, is that the upside for you? I mean, that's kind of the, you know, when you give to other people, what they receive, they give back to you.
I cannot imagine a more fulfilling job. You know, it's fabulous. And then working with students who are so appreciative of being able to learn this. And I have so many students who say, oh, I really want to work with you, Janet, because I love to work with patients with aphasia, with adult patients. So I get a lot from the students as well as the patients.
Very special people.
And in fact, I had one very special student, Barbara Leonard, Greg's wife. And she was one of our students several years ago and is now a professional in the community. And I'd say she had a big part to do with this high aphasia for aphasia.
Awesome. Well, we got to take a quick break right here at the bottom of the hour. Folks, when we come back, we're going to talk about high aphasia for aphasia. I don't think you want to miss it because it's very, very cool. So stick around for more here on The Fred and Jeff Show. The Fred and Jeff Show is brought to you by H&S Garden Service, Mayfield Florist, and Arizona Party Rental.
Now, time for more of the Fred and Jeff Show on 104.1 The Truth.
Hola, folks. Welcome back to the Fred and Jeff Show. This is Jeff Ronstadt without my big brother Fred, who has been called away for some sort of life-saving detail somewhere here in the old Pueblo. Fred, whatever you're doing, I hope you're having fun because we miss you here on the show. But anyhow, thanks for tuning into the Fred and Jeff Show. We talk about the people, the places, the events, history and culture that make living in Tucson and Southern Arizona so gosh darn wonderful. Thank you, Fred. And if you'd like to hear more about the folks that we've chatted with, you can go to the Fred and Jeff Show website at fredandjeff.com. You can like us on Facebook, where we post all kinds of great happenings here in Southern Arizona. Or follow us on Twitter, where every once in a while Fred will tweet something about what he's doing that, you know, isn't that exciting. But but it's something fun to do. So with us on the show today are some very, very cool neighbors of ours. We've got Janet Hawley, who we've just been chatting with. Janet's the clinical professor and speech-language pathologist at the University of Arizona. And Janet, just before we took the break, you mentioned the High Aphasia for Aphasia program. Can you tell our listeners what is that?
Well, Greg Leonard came to me and said, Janet, I have this really cool idea.
Now, wait a second. Who's Greg Leonard?
Well, would you like to introduce Greg?
All right, folks. In the studio with us as well is Greg Leonard. And Greg, I'm sitting here with your business card, and it says you are a research scientist in the Department of Hydrology and Water Resources here at the University of Arizona.
Yeah, that's right, Jeff. I've been with this department for 5 years now, and most of my projects, I work looking at glaciers with satellite imagery.
So Tucson's a perfect place to be to check out glaciers.
Well, that's what attracted me here, of course.
First off, where are you from?
I'm from Philadelphia, originally.
And what brought you to Tucson?
Well, I did my undergraduate work here in the 80s and into the early 90s in geology. And after that, I moved on and did exploration around the globe for minerals.
No kidding.
And also, after that was finished, I moved back to Tucson and got a position at the university working on this glacier project.
So let's talk about working around the globe, checking out minerals and stuff. Tell us more about that. That sounds very intriguing.
Yeah, that's right. Some geologists end up in economic geology, which I did for a period of time.
And what's economic geology?
Economic geology is the exploration for minerals that we use in our everyday lives. You know, iron, nickel, gold, silver, you know, copper.
All that, yeah.
You know, we're very familiar with that here in Tucson. The copper industry is quite prevalent here. So I worked for companies that were exploring for deposits. And I got to work in Indonesia in the jungles for 4 years.
Oh, wow.
Worked in Mongolia for 8 years. And some other places in between, too.
What was it like working in Mongolia?
Well, it is a proverbial Outer Mongolia. It's landlocked. It's remote. It's extreme in its temperatures, freezing in the winter and scorching in the summers. Fascinating, amazing culture. Really had a good experience there, and it was difficult to leave.
Okay, now wait a second. You're from Philadelphia. Come to Tucson, get your degree, get on a ship, fly out to Mongolia for 8 years, and it's hard to leave Mongolia?
Well, like any place, including Tucson, of course, for those people who sadly have to depart, it's always hard to leave because
sure.
the friendships that are established okay. and, you know, the work that's, you know, that I was doing there, I was very dedicated to the work and really enjoyed being in the field quite a bit.
So it wasn't so much the environment, it was the people that made it hard to leave.
Always.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's right.
And can you give us more idea of what specifically you're doing in Mongolia? Were you just looking for deposits of specific minerals?
Yeah, that was my day job. You know, I would go out in vehicles for as few as a few days to upwards to maybe a month or 2 months even, living and working out of camps or sleeping on the ground or, you know, whatever I had to do to get access places where we thought there was some mineral potential. And we would make maps and collect rocks and do geochemical and geophysical testing, ultimately drill testing, too, to see if we would find minerals.
And were you successful?
Yes, but that's a complex question because these things take a long time to understand sometimes what is actually occurring below the ground. So there are still some projects there that are being explored and may ultimately be, you know, mined and then become successful projects.
Oh, that's very
But I am not associated with that industry any longer. And
so now you're back at the U of A.
That's right.
But so I guess the question I want to ask you now is the real reason we have you guys here today is to talk about the High Asia for Aphasia that you guys are doing, which I think is incredible. But I guess my point is you worked and lived in this high-stress environment, and you liked it. And did you do climbing? Did you do all kinds of stuff like that while you were in Mongolia and all of these amazing other countries?
Yeah, part of the work can be quite physical because it's really remote areas. There's mountains, and as I mentioned, in Indonesia, jungles. Quite a challenging environment to be, you know, confronted with. So, yeah, the job involved adventuring, and sometimes that involved a little bit of climbing, walking through deserts, a whole variety of really interesting places, and I'm grateful to have that experience.
Well, yeah, that's great experience. So you guys have a connection through your wife, and so can you tell our listeners about the connection and the fruit that relationship has bear?
Well, my wife, Barbara, was a graduate student a couple of years ago in the Department of Speech and Language at the University of Arizona. And through my wife, I learned a lot about various communication disorders. One of them is aphasia. So I decided late last year that I wanted to do a climb, and a significant climb, something on the order of 7,000 meters, which is 23,000 feet.
Wow.
Now,
just by way of comparison, how tall is Mount Lemmon?
Mount Lemmon is about 9,200 feet.
9,200 feet to the pinnacle of Mount Lemmon.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're talking about something
two and a half.
Wow.
Yeah.
And where do you go to find a mountain like that?
Well, there's only one place you can go to find 7,000 meter peaks, and that's at the Himalayas or into the Pamirs in Tajikistan or up in the Tian Shan, which is Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan. So I decided to do a mountain in northern India called Kun, K-U-N, and that is 23,354 feet in height.
That's amazing. So tell us, okay, so what's the connection between your climb and aphasia?
Well, I decided to do this climb, and I realized this is something bigger than I've ever done. And I was looking at the resource outlay, the time, the commitment, the training. I thought, this is all fine for me to feed my spirit to get to the summit. I thought maybe there's some other spirits I could feed as well. So I thought, I want to make this about something bigger than me. So I brought this question to my wife. And Barbara said, well, what about bringing awareness to aphasia? And right then and there popped in my head the slogan, High Asia for Aphasia.
All right.
And it just sounded too good, and that's how the campaign was born. We started to brainstorm some ideas of what we could do, and immediately Barbara thought about Janet and her connection at the university, and particularly the adult aphasia clinic that she has established some time ago. And we just started talking and coming up with ideas. And that's how the project and the campaign was born.
So is climbing to a peak that high, is it life-threatening? I mean, could you put yourself in mortal danger by doing something like that?
Yeah, the answer is yes.
That was a big softball question for you.
Yeah.
This is quite an undertaking to promote aphasia. And had you, what was the highest peak you'd climb prior to doing this?
That would have been in Ecuador, and it would have been on the order of 18,000 feet.
So this is substantially more.
It is indeed. And once you get above 20, 22,000, I could see that things change quite a bit. The logistics required, how many people required. You need to have Sherpa support in Himalayas to do this kind of climb.
I used to have a Sherpa. Yeah, here in town. Yeah, I was a sophomore and he was a freshman. He used to, just kidding. Trying to make a connection, Greg.
You would do very well to have a Sherpa because they are some of the most wonderful, genuine, hardworking peoples that I've ever met anywhere on the planet.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's awesome. So you just decide, gosh, I'm going to feed my spirit and who else can I help in the process? And High Asia for Aphasia is born.
Yeah, that's exactly how it was born. And it was rather rapid fire. And we ramped up the campaign quickly. And it's been successful to this day.
Awesome. All right, we got to take our last break of the hour. And when we come back, I want to hear all about this climb. It sounds amazing. So, folks, stick around. We'll be right back with more here on The Fred and Jeff Show.
This portion of the Fred and Jeff Show is brought to you by Power Woman Investing, Ronstadt Insurance, and 1702 Craft Beer and Pizza.
Now, time for more of the Fred and Jeff Show on 104.1 The Truth.
And welcome back here on our final segment of this fabulous Sunday on the Fred and Jeff Show. And with me in the studio... Oh, darn. I always forget to do Fred's line. And that's, welcome back to the Fred and Jeff Show, where we talk about the people, the places, the events, history, and culture that make Tucson and Southern Arizona a wonderful place. Follow us on Facebook. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. I'm horrible at this because Fred does it all the time. But you guys get the idea that we're out there, and we want you folks to meet the neighbors that make Tucson a great place to live. And with me in the studio today is Janet Hawley. From the University of Arizona, she's a speech pathologist. Hi, Janet.
Hello.
And the guy we're talking to now, Greg Leonard, who is, I love what you put down on your little thing, Greg, climber. But actually, you're more than a climber because you're a research scientist in the Department of Hydrology and Water Resources here at the U of A. And we were just talking about High Asia for Aphasia and how you... climbed up to the summit of an amazing, well, let's, you tell the story, because this is an amazing story, folks. Talk about someone who wanted to find the highest peak he could and get a megaphone and shout to everybody about what aphasia is. You found that peak, and tell our listeners how you got up there.
That's quite a story, and I'll give you a link to our website, which I expand on the story in the form of a blog.
Perfect.
But it takes quite a bit to get up to a 23,000-foot mountain.
And remind me, where's the mountain?
The mountain's in northern India. It's in the Kashmir part of India, and that's way up in the Himalayas. The Himalaya chain runs all the way across, you know, Nepal and India and up into Pakistan and eastwards into Myanmar as well. But I chose this mountain for a couple of reasons. And one is nobody knew about it. I like kind of crazy out-of-the-way places.
But are these crazy out-of-the-way places more dangerous than the not-so-crazy out-of-the-way places?
From maybe a remote standpoint and the idea that maybe there's not many or any other teams on the mountain to offer assistance if there was some difficulty.
That's important, yeah.
And fortunately, the climb has been successful, and we didn't have any serious or life-threatening issues on the mountain, and it went very well.
So how many folks went up the mountain with you?
There were ultimately five climbers. One of the climbers had some altitude sickness at about 14,000 feet, and sadly she couldn't stay. But the rest of us were successful in making it to the summit.
And were all five of you doing this to, you know, promote awareness for aphasia?
I was the only one. The other climbers were from India. And there was also somebody from Australia.
How did you hook up with these guys?
Well, we got hooked up through the logistics provider that helps to provide services and some guidance on the mountain itself. And I met them all once I got to India and found out these would be my climbing partners.
That's crazy. So here's this guy, Greg, living in Tucson, Arizona, meets his wife. By the way, where's your wife from?
She's from Colorado.
Okay, so she came here to the U of A to get her degree?
Yeah, through Arizona, too. She eventually moved to Arizona in high school, but went to the graduate program, as I mentioned, here at the University of Arizona just a couple of years ago.
And that's where you met her?
No, we met in Flagstaff, Arizona in the late 90s.
Were you up there climbing around?
We were doing a little bit of climbing, a lot of adventuring. I was working in Indonesia at the time. She eventually found work also in Indonesia, and we started dating there, and many years in Southeast Asia and all across Asia.
And you're both back in Tucson.
We're both back in Tucson.
Very cool.
Very happy to be
and
here.
And was your wife cool with you doing this climb?
She was. We have climbed together, and in fact, in 2000, on our wedding anniversary, we were about 20,000 feet in the Ecuadorian Andes together, so she is at least my equal, if not a better climber than I am. But sadly, she could not be on this Indian climb because, you know, time, she had to come back to Tucson.
That's amazing. So you pick this place, you get hooked up with the logistical company there, and off you go. I mean, I'm completely oversimplifying it, but off you go. And so from the base to the summit, how long does it take you?
Well, we were planning on 4 weeks. This is expedition style. When you get above 22,000 feet, you really need to start worrying about acclimatizing to altitudes.
Okay, so expedition style is very different from Gangnam style?
Yeah, quite different than Gangnam style.
What does expedition style mean?
Yeah, expedition means that you need to establish your acclimatization at different altitude levels. And that might mean shuttling supplies up to, say, 18,000 feet, then returning back down to, you know, 14,000, 15,000 feet to sleep. And you sort of do that in a stage fashion, up and down the mountain in little segments.
Okay,
slowly
so
working your way up.
Do you have a set trail from the base to the pinnacle?
Not so much a set trail. I mean, it's a wild place. This is an icy, glaciated mountain, and we rely heavily on the Sherpas that are there because they set fixed lines on some of the more dicey and challenging sections. Fixed lines are ropes, essentially, that we can hook onto with special equipment and more safely then, you know, ascend really steep, icy slopes to get to the next camp.
And when you're up there doing this, are you wearing the shoes with the spikes on them, and you got the ice pick and the carabiners? And
got it all, man.
This is a full on. So I'm watching Clint Eastwood in the Eiger Sanction, and they're ascending this peak. That's the kind of thing you're doing.
Yeah, exactly. Great movie, by the way.
I mean, so those of us that are, you know, born and raised, and we don't travel too far outside of our little, you know, our little community here, what you're describing to me is so foreign.
Mm-hmm.
Here you are. You just did this climb, what, 2 weeks ago?
Well, I stood on the summit of this mountain a month ago yesterday.
A month ago yesterday.
And if you would indulge me, I have just a paragraph here from my blog, but I think it describes a little bit my experience going towards the summit and being on the summit.
All right, have at it.
On July 26, 6:15 a.m., I stood atop the icy, thin-aired summit of Coon Mountain at 23,354 feet. My fingers, frozen from the sub-zero temperatures, fumbled with a High Asia for Aphasia banner, but I managed to slowly unfurl it and place it across my chest as my Sherpa climbing partner, Nima, snapped a few photos. The batteries died after two pictures, and Nima extracted them from the camera, rubbed them vigorously between his hands, reviving them enough for a few more exposures to be taken. Over the next 5 to 10 minutes, the other members of the climbing team trickled to the summit, one by one. We had done it. Climbed a technical 7,000-meter peak in the far western Himalaya, far above the clouds, closer to the stars, living out our dreams, sharing the moment. No doubt, the final summit push on Coon Mountain was the hardest I've experienced as a climber. My lungs strained to inhale enough oxygen to sustain the strenuous efforts of my steep upward ascent. My stomach ached from needing more nutrition that was difficult to intake with sufficient quantities at this altitude, and my feet were frozen and my body shook from hypothermia. I was so grateful to be on the summit, carrying the High Asia for Aphasia banner. I was equally grateful to begin the descent into the direction of the orange rays of the rising sun.
That's very cool. So, were you handwriting this stuff as you're going up the mountain?
Oh, gosh, no. I was just trying to survive with getting air into my lungs. I wrote this when I got back to the high camp, Camp 3, as we call it, at about 22,000 feet. So I got back to camp and, you know, I always try to write some notes about my experience.
Well, over two times the height of Mount Lemmon, and that was high camp. And from there, you had another, what, 2,000-3,000 feet to go till you got to...
Yeah, at that point from high camp, it was another 1,000, 1,500 feet or so.
And was it straight up?
Not straight up, fortunately, but there were sections, you know, 60 to 70 degree ice and a very thin, what we call, sort of a fine razor sharp ridges. And you're looking off on one direction, going down maybe 3,000 feet, another direction, 6,000 feet off on that slope.
Wow. How many folks make it to the summit of that mountain every year?
Well, I would say just a small handful. It's not a very well-known mountain, and it's in a remote area, and it's in Kashmir, geopolitically a little bit sensitive.
Oh, yeah,
so not everybody chooses to go to that particular mountain. So it's only a very small handful, maybe a dozen, maybe a couple dozen.
And Jenna was saying that during your ascent, that you, what happened where some, you found a marker where someone had passed away in their ascent? What was that story, Janet?
Well, when Greg was near the summit waiting, shaking with hypothermia, waiting for the rest of the group to come up and kind of catch up with him at that point, he was standing at this point, and later they all came and they went to the top. But he found out that that particular place was where someone had died last year. There was an avalanche situation, and the person had been drugged down the mountain.
Oh, wow. So it was pretty perilous going
up
there.
So when you ask about life-threatening, it's definitely. And I think Greg really speaks to the fact that people who've had strokes struggle every day to communicate and to ambulate, to get around. And he compares this incredible journey to what they deal with on a daily basis. And I really admire that.
I admire that, too. I mean, I'm in awe of you because of what you were able to accomplish.
Yeah, thanks. I can add a little bit to that. I think people that do struggle with aphasia, it's like mountain climbing in the way that there's a physical challenge. There's actually something physical. You know, there's a brain injury that's occurred. There's physical challenges for them to be able to learn how to communicate effectively again or communicate in whatever way they can. There's the mental as well, and that's just believing that they can indeed improve. And emotional as well, because, you know, our ability to communicate with others is critical for us to feel part of
community,
part of even our own families.
Sure.
So all these are wrapped up together, the physical, the mental, the emotional. And this is what climbers experience as well. There's other challenges on the mountain.
So there are over a million people in the United States right now that suffer from aphasia. And this campaign to get the word out that there is such a thing called aphasia and it's curable, by and large, it's curable.
It's treatable.
Treatable. What else do you want people to know? I mean, the pulpit is yours now. Tell people out there what you want them to know about this.
Well, people with aphasia are an amazing group to me. Most of the people I meet really, really want to continue to receive treatment, continue to improve. And unfortunately, medical insurance runs out very quickly, usually within 3 months after their stroke or injury. So many of them come to us seeking treatment and look to us to see if we have scholarships to support their treatment. So one thing Greg wanted to do was to encourage donations for scholarship for treatments. You know, the money goes entirely to treatment.
And people want to give, where is there a website that our listeners can go to give to help people with the treatment?
Yeah, that's right. Our campaign, our project is set up, highasiaforaphasia.com. That's high as in H-I-G-H, like a high mountain, High Asia for Aphasia. And aphasia is A-P-H-A-S-I-A, aphasia.
Right. Well, we'll have a link on that, to that website on our webpage, friendjeff.com, which is, you know, a little easier to spell than that. Mm-hmm. But we'll totally have a link on there. So, folks, if you'd like to help out with folks that have aphasia, scholarships for them to get treatment, click on the friendjeff.com website, go to that link, and your dollars are greatly, greatly appreciated.
And even a small amount of money, each group per week is 35. So for a semester of like 14 weeks of therapy for a patient, it's less than $500 approximately. So
we're not talking a ton of money.
We're not talking a ton of money.
Awesome.
And it's really, these patients are incredibly appreciative.
Thank you. You guys, thanks for what you do. Thanks for deciding that Tucson was going to be your home, and thanks for making Tucson a better place to live. We really appreciate what you guys do.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff.
Absolutely. Folks, that's another Fred and Jeff show. Tune in next week when the old Fred will be back on the show for a little jocularity. And go out there and make it a great week. Meet your neighbors and enjoy what's left of the summer into the fall. So have a great week.
Your love.